Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Rachel. It's nice to see you.
Good to see you. What's on your mind today?
Well, there's a few things on my mind, as always. When I was thinking about the show and kind of the subject matter of the show, which is around intergenerational trauma and how experiences are passed down from generation to next generation, I was thinking about, you know, my training as a family systems therapist. That's really my area of specialty, and how these patterns of behavior like anxiety, depression, personality traits, our interest in the career that we choose, physical health, mental health are passed along kind of from generation to generation. If your family has a history of divorce, that tends to be passed along generation to generation. And a few years ago, my daughter Kelly and I, one of our, you know, trips back east, we ended up, and I don't know if you remember this, we ended up at a place called Lilydale in upstate New York. And Lilydale is the Center for Spiritualism, which is a whole nother show. And you can listen to it if you do a little deep dive. Maybe I'll have Sasha look up that show so we can tell you when it aired. But Lilydale was a fascinating experience because it's inhabited by psychics. Again, whole nother story. But the point of the story is that Kelly, my younger daughter, happened to have an interaction with one of the Lilydale spiritualists. And of course, I love the things that are out of the blue. And she said to Kelly, "You carry your grandmother's and your great grandmother's and your great great grandmother's unfulfilled lives. And they sit on your chest and in your throat. And they are waiting for you to speak and sing and do the things they never got to do. And that's a lot of weight to carry." And it was such a profound moment because I, again, from a clinical standpoint, had thought about it from those, you know, obvious things like marriage habits and, you know, career choices, but not from the unfulfilled or unlived or unresolved issues piece being passed along through the women of multiple generations in my family. And I even felt it in myself because Kelly and I are so connected in ways that I felt her carrying maybe some of the burdens of my unresolved experiences. But to go back three more generations and to be able to really connect the genes or the skill set that Kelly has and how they do really connect to her great, great grandmother. And so that's been on my mind this week. Actually in the last month, because I read an article in my trusty Psychotherapy Networker magazine, which is kind of our go-to book of all the latest and greatest that's going on in the field of mental health. And I flipped open to an article called "The Legacy of Historical Trauma, Grasping the Larger Story." And I read this article written by Anita Manley about her experience growing up in her family and how it took an experience with one of her clients to recognize that although she'd grown up in a loving, supportive household, she was carrying the weight of trauma and experiences of her relatives and ancestors. And so I reached out to Anita and said, "I think I have to know you. I think we have to share some stories because I am fascinated by this emerging work around healing ancestral trauma, intergenerational trauma, and how we bring that to the forefront of therapy that we're doing today, because so many people get stuck. They get stuck in not being able to resolve or move forward, and they end up feeling victimized. They end up feeling broken, like, this is my fault. I'm the one who's addicted. I'm not strong enough to leave a bad relationship. I'm not smart enough to finish college. I'm not wise enough to solve all these issues." And so it prevents them from ever having successful therapy because they become weighted down by this toxic story that they somehow, as an individual, are broken and sick. And when you can bring in this greater story or possibility that it's not about you being broken or sick, but you are carrying the weight of experiences of your ancestors that are preventing you from being able to live your most full life, that changes everything. And so that's where we're going today. I'm lucky enough to have Anita Manley with us today to talk about her work and her upcoming book, Healing Cultural and Intergenerational Trauma, A Decolonized Trauma Healing Model. So we're going to get deep into all of it with Anita's story and the work that she's doing. And although we don't have the phone lines open as we usually do, you can ask questions. If you'd like to, give us a call at 805-549-8855. And Rachel will be happy to read your questions over the air so we can answer you. And if you'd like to join us on Instagram Live, go to The Reluctant Therapist on Instagram. We are now live streaming. You can see Anita in her place in Chicago, and you'll see myself and Sasha and Rachel. So you can join us that way. You can send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also follow us on our Facebook page and Instagram for all the latest and greatest. So here we are for today. We've got a full hour planned. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to start our conversation with Anita Manley. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Somebody that just loves to learn, and another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn. Mom loves the both of them, you see it's in the blood. Both kids are good and mom, blood's thicker than the mud, it's a family affair.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And my guest today is psychotherapist Anita Manley. She is from Chicago, Illinois. She is part of the Center for Contextual Change. She's led the Centers and Adult Integrative Trauma Team and Dialectical Behavior Therapy Teams. She trains and consults with other clinicians about integrative psychotherapy. Anita actually created integrative trauma recovery therapy. And we're going to kind of unpack what all of that means. But Anita brings over 30 years of experience to her work, and also her philosophy that understanding clients' distress must come in the context of the whole self, body, mind, brain, and spirit. That we can only understand someone's experience when we look at their whole life and the lives of their ancestors. So Anita, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
I'm so excited to get to see you while we get to have our conversation. And also to try to make sense of a lot of terminology that's been coming up for people. We've been talking about on the air here, decolonizing therapy, intergenerational trauma. So I'm hoping that we can slowly kind of move through the definitions so that everyone kind of gets the understanding. I know that you train people in this, so it'll be right in your wheelhouse. But before we jump there, I'm always curious to know with fellow clinicians why you chose this path. Why did you choose to become a healer or a psychotherapist?
Well, Elizabeth, I do not have a particularly profound story. I was actually intending to become a doctor until I was in an anatomy class, and we had to dissect. When I realized I could not tolerate the sight of blood or dissecting any animal, I'm like, okay, what else can I do? So it's not a glorious story, but I'm like, okay, psychology, that sounds like fun. And so that's where I went.
When you went into field psychology, did you think, oh, I have a passion for doing talk therapy, or was there something about it that was interesting to you?
Well, I have to say the thing that actually first caught my awareness is sort of the way people responded to me. Mm. I started, you know, working in the field, and not with the intention of this being my life's work. I was just sort of, okay, I'll hang out here till something better shows up. And then I realized that people responded to me for some reason and would tell me things, and that I was drawn to the stories that people would share with me, and that also noticing the power of the relationship and kind of feeling like, you know, in all humility, that I had a gift around relationship, and that relationship actually provided the context for healing. And I never really saw people as broken. Even when I worked with the chronically mentally ill, I always knew that I was looking at wounds. And so I began to ponder the possibility that given the right context, the right resources, and the context of relationship, people could heal. And so that's where I kind of got started. And then I began to realize that no matter who I was working with clinically, they'd all experienced trauma. I look at trauma as a lot less about an event and much more about the impact. And when the impact of the event leaves someone feeling powerless, disconnected, devalued, out of control, or someone around them's out of control, that's traumatic. And so once I realized that, whether they were schizophrenic or bipolar or depressed or had high anxiety, that they'd all felt powerless. They'd all felt disconnected in some way. They all felt devalued by their vulnerabilities and felt like they couldn't control, or what they were experiencing could not be controlled. And so that's sort of where I felt the focus of trauma itself. Yeah.
And do you feel that trauma is inherent in human experience in some way?
Yes. I think it's impossible not to go through life without having an experience of powerlessness or feeling devalued or disconnected or out of control. I think the difference revolves around the available resources. I think if we have, no matter what the event, if we have the necessary resources available to us, we can heal from the wound of a trauma. But when our vulnerabilities surpass our resources, and then we're sort of in a quandary.
Yeah. When you mentioned in the article, that's how I first got to know you, was flipping through the Psychotherapy Networker in your Legacy of Historical Trauma article. You talked about growing up in your own loving, supportive family, and you felt that it was somehow, it kind of buffered you from, you know, you had this place of safety that you always felt supported. And is that part of the key to being able to move through our life, is that we have a buffer of support that we can go to when we hit those inevitable traumas, and that some people don't have that buffer?
Absolutely. And I did experience sort of the nuanced traumas in my family. For example, my grandmother's mother's family, my grandmother's mother died when my grandmother was 13, and my grandmother was the oldest of 6 children, and she died from an illness that was quite prevalent in her family. And my guess is, or the best guess that people have, is that it was connected to some sort of like marriage, I want to say, between cousins, actually. And it was because at that point in time, slaves and free people of color weren't routinely allowed to marry. So free people of color, which her mother was a free person of color, or, you know, for generations, her family was free. Who else were they going to marry but second, third cousins or whatever? And they developed a genetically transmitted illness very similar to ALS. And so my grandmother's mother died from it, and many of her siblings, most of her siblings, had that illness. And so the other piece was, tell you the truth, Elizabeth, I couldn't figure out. There were missing pieces of the story, because I'm like, they're all good people. Why are they like suffering? Why is this suffering in my family? From my grandmother coming back crying because she got tricked again about registering the vote. This was in New Orleans, to just all sorts of things. One of her brothers was killed in the army in Germany by American soldiers. A lot of stories like that. And as I've gotten more into this topic and worked more with it as a trainer and as a clinician, it's actually become clearer and clearer to me, like how much this has impacted me and the trajectory of my family. Right? Because that's what trauma does. It disrupts the natural flow, right? Through time, the natural trajectory and development. And in this case of my family, you know, things have shown up that might not have been there had it not been for these conditions and circumstances.
So I wonder if part of you said you just kind of fell into doing this healer work. You were going to be a doctor, but maybe it wasn't so accidental. I mean, maybe that's what was carried forward to you, that you were the person that would be healing, not just doing this work in the world, but the healing for your ancestral traumas.
I think you might be right, Elizabeth, that at the time I might have thought of it as accidental, mm-hmm. right? Or, you know, coincidental. But if I look at the trajectory, it does seem like there was a flow, mm-hmm. right? And that I am exactly in the spot that I should be in. And I feel like that with my clients, that there's a reason they're with me.
Yeah, I actually do believe that people find us when they need us, or that the work that we're doing gets found when it's most important. If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Fair, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest today is Anita Manley. She's a psychotherapist with 30 years experience. She is the creator of integrative trauma recovery therapy. And we're talking today about what intergenerational trauma looks like. So, Anita, let's jump into your integrative trauma recovery work. What does that look like? How does that differ from contextual work that you were doing before? Or how does it connect with the work you're doing before?
Yeah, I think connects with. I don't think necessarily totally different. I think there's a place where they overlap, mm-hmm. Lay on top of each other. My integrative trauma work actually started, I used to do a lot of DBT, dialectical behavior therapy.
You need to define it for everybody.
Dialectical behavior therapy is a type of, it's an offshoot of cognitive behavior therapy, developed by Dr. Marsha Linehan at the University of Washington in Seattle. And basically what she realized was that even though the population that she was most interested in, which that population was women who had been diagnosed with a personality disorder called borderline personality disorder, and women who were chronically suicidal, and at that point in time, hospitalized maybe for a year, even 2 years, right? That initially she thought, oh, okay, they'll respond. There's a healing aspect to cognitive behavior therapy. We'll apply that. And the therapy just blew up. And so she decided to think about what's missing. And what she decided was missing was practices that lie more within the realm of Eastern mindfulness practices and acceptance strategies. And so what she did was develop this model of dialectical behavior therapy, in the dialectic meaning finding the middle path that held both Western concepts of thought and behavior and change strategies, along with Eastern concepts of ways of being with distress and pain, which included being non-judgmental, accepting, willing to experience the pain and not try to shut it down, which would then lead to the suffering. So I was doing a lot of that. And I was working with a client who had a pretty powerful childhood trauma story and had a lot of problematic behaviors, self-injury, addiction to benzos or anti-anxiety meds, problematic use of alcohol, all sorts of things. And I'd gone through my entire repertoire of strategies, and she still had all of this. So I said, well, we got to heal the trauma. Maybe that's where it is. And so I went to a training on prolonged exposure. So I came back with this protocol. And then I sat down, we did our protocol. I'd been seeing her probably close to 2 years by then. And so we were attached to one another. And the protocol included listening to the story over and over again of her trauma, which lasted from the time she was 2 to she was 6. And I did it, and I thought I was going to lose my mind. I could barely tolerate it because I started seeing the images of her abuse. Mm-hmm. And just so connected to her and this then the story, and I was like, oh my gosh. Now, the curious thing is, I actually started talking to her during these sessions, and like just saying things like, I'm here with you, and I'm so sorry, things like that, which wasn't necessarily part of the protocol, but I couldn't stop myself. So the interesting thing was, even though I hated the process, some of those behaviors, she let them go. So, two things. I said to myself, what's actually happening here? What actually was the healing, number one? And could that, the second question was, could that happen without a story?
Right, without having to tell it and tell it and tell it and reactivate it.
Exactly, exactly. And in conversation with her and processing it, she told me the difference for her was that I was with her, that she was not alone, because part of the story is that the abuse would happen when her mother would go to work and when she was alone with the offender. And she said what was different was that even though in telling it, she was with this offender again, she was not alone with him. Mm-hmm. Right? And then So I was like, wow, that's the power of one, something being different. The healing power of the disparity from the trauma, original trauma, and the power of a secure base, someone who shows up as the witness, the protector, the comforter, even in the midst of trauma. So that's when I began my journey towards trying to find out how could I find healing practices that didn't require a story, the narrative. And that's when I got interested in some of the expressive work, which I'd known a little bit about, but I began using like art, collage making, those sorts of things more. And then we had a person who started working in our practice who did a lot of yoga and did somatic experiencing. And so then I got into the body as a resource and how without a verbal story, the story shows up in the body. And if you can go to the direct place in the body where the wound is and create some disparity there, something different, that you create the, you set up the initial conditions and create the context for healing. I hope I'm making sense. I hope it's not rambling.
No, it's okay because, you know, again, I want these stories to be shared because when people are searching for healing, reason we have this show is that I don't want people to just look in the phone book and say, there's someone with a license. They must all do the same work because we don't all do the same work. And I think that's so, what you're talking about is so critical because the person who you're talking about found you. We said it earlier in the show, people find us, right? We find who we're supposed to find. She made an attachment with you and that attachment, that safe attachment allowed her to free up this experience. And so I think that to me, that's what I'm hearing all along is that you were able to discover that there are many roads to helping people unlock their wounds. The protocol of telling the story over and over is one way, but then you found through expressive arts and creating a safe space and also your capacity to hold someone's story, which I also think you mentioned at the beginning is key to doing this work that psychotherapists are not just trained to listen, that we bring a healing capacity with us. I want as many people as possible to hear all the nuances that go into talk therapy or healing or expressive works. This is a good breather spot. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. And Rachel, did we have a call?
Yeah, Elizabeth. Matt from Santa Maria is wondering if Anita practices other modalities outside the box of psychology, things like Reiki or kinesiology.
So I do somatic experiencing, which was developed by Peter Levine. I also do a type of somatic healing practice, transforming the experience-based brain. I've trained with Stephen Terrell. His program is in Austin. And it involves a type of touch, actually. When we're on the ground in person, I do the somatic touch work for regulation and for almost a cellular type of reorganization with the trauma and healing. And even oddly enough, surprisingly enough, I should say, to me and other people, as I'm able to even do it intentionally over the Zoom, which is a really kind of a, in a way, mystical experience for me, that how I can access or I can communicate with a person in their body, what they're holding in their body, even over the Zoom. It's kind of weird, yeah. But it's true at the same time.
It's how we're learning to transfer energy in different ways instead of just being in the same room. I mean, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to my guest, Anita Mandley. She's a psychotherapist from Chicago, Illinois. She is in the process of writing a book, Healing Cultural and Intergenerational Trauma, a Decolonized Trauma Healing Model. And we're here today kind of walking through that path to uncovering what intergenerational trauma looks like. As always, you can be part of the conversation by giving us a call. And Rachel will read your question over the phone, 805-549-8855. Thanks to all of you who are visiting with us on Instagram Live right now. It's nice to see you. And if you'd like to jump on Instagram Live, you can see my friend Anita and myself and Rachel. And that's just The Reluctant Therapist. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back to continue our conversation. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Fathers be good to your daughters. Daughters will love like you do. Girls become lovers who turn into mothers. So mothers be good to your daughters too. Skin. It's the same she's been standing in since the day she saw him walking away. Now she's left cleaning up the mess he made. So fathers, be good to your daughters.
This is listener-supported public radio, KCBX. Thanks for listening this afternoon, supporting your local station. It's 2:32. Coming up at 3 o'clock is Fresh Air. Thanks for listening to this conversation with The Reluctant Therapist. If you have questions you want to have answered, you can call them in at 805-549-8855. Back to you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Rachel. And Anita, I'm so glad to have you here today. And let's kind of jump into the intergenerational piece. I talked at the top of the show about understanding that our patterns of divorce and mental health and marriage can kind of get passed along generation to generation. I've always understood that. I understood that, you know, all of us are a culmination of our own lived experiences, but also the lived experiences of our ancestors. Who may or may not have known. And so we're kind of carrying that weight of whatever our grandmothers and great-grandmothers, great-grandfathers experienced actually can change their DNA and RNA in such a way that it changes what's passed down genetically, which impacts who we are today. It sounds complex and so fascinating, and yet when you really think about it, it makes so much sense. But I want to talk about the article that you wrote about the legacy of historical trauma and how you found, kind of discovered that it existed, but not through your own experience, but through one of your clients.
Right. So I had a client that I'd been seeing for about 3 years, a Jewish woman in her early 40s, and a survivor. And as we were leaving a session, and I walk my clients out to the waiting room. When they leave, she turned to me and she said, "It's so nice to have a therapist who's a survivor." And I was like, just getting ready to say, "No, I'm not a survivor. You know, I've never been abused or anything like that." But then for some reason, nothing, no words came out. I didn't say anything. And it was about a day or so later that I had this vivid image slash memory. And it was of me in New Orleans. I used to visit my maternal grandmother every summer. And so I was at her house. And it was on a Sunday afternoon. And the image is of a small black and white TV, and we're watching it, and it was the equivalent of breaking news, what we call breaking news. And it was the Huntley and Brinkley breaking news, which sort of tells people how old I am, but and the breaking news of the day was the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. And the death of the four little girls, the murder. And I remember sitting there thinking, huh, they went to Sunday school. I had just gone to Sunday school. They went to church. I'd been to church. They were on their way down to church. They were dead. They were the same age as me. They were dead. And I had this awareness that it was highly likely that there could be people who wanted me dead and didn't even know my name. Right? And it was at that moment, and just even noticing the freeze that happened in my body when I had that image and that thought, that narrative came to my mind that I was a survivor. And I was a survivor of culture and historical trauma. And so since then, I've had like many moments like that, where all of a sudden things that I had either suppressed or repressed or dismissed as inconsequential began to like become vivid again. And then perhaps also the combination of learning a lot about somatic therapies and feeling that happened in my body and the impact, and notice the impulses and my responses to the threat response. I just was like, oh my gosh, I've been living with this all my life, right? And living with the stories of my ancestors and how, not just their story, but like, and not just their vulnerabilities, but also their resiliencies. How I've experienced those all my life. Yeah.
And so one of the things you talked about is post-traumatic slavery syndrome. What does that look like generations out? How are you seeing that show up?
It shows up, I think, even genetically, or not genetic, in our nervous systems.
Okay.
It's a function of the genetic transmission, but in our nervous system and sort of what our vulnerabilities are, you know, or the way in which we feel vulnerable with certain activation. I'll put it like that. How that shows up in the body, how it like impacts what we're afraid of and what we feel safe with, how it impacts the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, how it shows up in the ways we parent, how it shows up, you know, like in terms of parenting, you know, I do trainings with agencies that do a lot of work with social welfare, child welfare. And one thing that I know they talk to me about is like, what do I make about like the how often or how much Black mothers spank their children. There's this whole movement now about let's not use corporal punishment, let's not spank. So I will have to make acknowledgement that on some level, well, on many levels, I've not experienced that. My family didn't really spank much, if at all. And if they spanked, they cried at the same time because it hurt. So anyway, but that's rooted in slavery. You know, I did some research so I could say that I knew what I was talking about. And I researched spanking and corporal punishment of children in Africa. Couldn't find a record of it. So I'm like, well, how did that pattern develop? Did more research, and it seems like it developed in slavery. And how it developed was if a slave child misbehaved, they could actually be sold, right? The parents, the mothers would lose their children. Even if they weren't sold, they might get whipped. Not whipped with a switch or a belt. I'm talking about leather strips that tore into their backs, right? They would even, sometimes the overseers would dig a little trench, and the child would lay stomach down, face down in the trench, so that the lip would lay flat and be able to access more of the back, right? So mothers developed, I'm not sure if it was conscious or unconscious, intentional, unintentional, I'm going to punish them and spank them in front of the overseer to the extent that he will know that this child has been sufficiently punished, and therefore maybe he'll let me keep him. Maybe he won't sell him. Maybe I can save my child from that other whip, right? And so it's really about threat and not anger. The level of threat we Black mothers can feel in their nervous system when their child misbehaves.
Right? And it's not just then of 2021 threat, but an intergenerational trauma, what you're talking about is something that's 200 years old, passed along
absolutely
in the nervous system of each of these women.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so I'm sorry.
Go on.
So how do we see that? Because you also mentioned addiction behaviors, you know, that one of the clients you talked about said, I feel like there's something wrong with me, but now maybe there's nothing wrong with me. I'm just playing out or experiencing my addictions are a response to things that were experienced three generations ago. How do you discover that in other ways?
Right. So I think there's this particular client, her parents immigrated to the United States after the war. I think they were from Czechoslovakia. The mother and her family had been captured by Nazis, although they escaped, but then they went back and fought in the underground. Her father had been captured by Russia, by the Russians, and was in a labor camp. And of course, after they immigrated, neither one of them were treated around trauma. That wasn't a thing. They began to drink a lot. They began to be abusive and always angry, right? She has multiple immune system related things. She had an addiction and a lot of physical symptoms. Her brother was born with type 1 diabetes. He also became addicted to prescription drugs and alcohol. Neither one really had a sustained romantic relationship at the time. And in all of her treatment, and she'd been through a lot, she was on a lot of meds. She'd been through a lot of treatment. The message with this emphasis on cognitive behavior therapy was that if she just thought different thoughts and did different behaviors, that everything would be fine. Mm-hmm. And if she didn't make these changes, there was something, either she was bad in some way or incompetent in some way.
Lazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when I began to tell her about even the genetic impact, like how trauma can change DNA and RNA, and just her looking at, okay, some of this stuff, the vulnerability, the sensitivity, like it's the excessive sensitivity to activation, the prolonged activation in response to the initial activation, and how long it took her to return to a baseline, and that everything that she was doing was some sort of defensive accommodation to manage unmanageable and intolerable activation, mm-hmm. and that she was never bad and never incompetent. She just started crying in my office, and she looked at me and she goes, "You mean it's not my fault?" I said, no. How could it have been any other way? And it was just, you could just see like little, like tissue paper layers of shame just began to fall away, right? Mm-hmm. That someone was seeing her as somebody other than a resistant, flawed, characterologically faulty client.
I feel that. And don't you feel a bit of guilt in that? Because I can picture the textbook in my master's program that talks about resistant clients, right? Or clients who refuse to accept what is. And when it makes me cringe inside that there's even part of the training to let therapists off the hook in some way when a client doesn't respond to different treatments, that it's somehow the client's fault. I mean, that's built into our graduate school trainings.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I had another client, Argentinian by culture, and it had in round two a really profound disconnection with the parents in terms of being left in order for them to pursue their careers or whatever. And so I had a profound attachment problem when people would leave. And I was her backup for her individual therapist when he would go on vacation. And she would like be out of control, really suicidal. So one time I decided, well, what I learned is you make a safety plan. You get out your pad, your pencil, right? And you write down all these strategies, right? But the wound was not cognitive. So she gets up, she starts pacing, I'm writing in my safety plan, and then eventually her fist goes through the wall in my office, and I'm like, I made a mistake.
She's not feeling safe.
And she just was terrified and horrified and felt like I was going to kick her out, that the center would never let her back into the office and all this. And I just realized I was so misattuned. And that was just like the original trauma, the misattunement.
Mm-hmm. Another adult that wasn't getting it.
Exactly. And that the wound was on the attachment. Mm-hmm. And if I had just said, I'm going to be right here with you the whole time, knowing that I would be the resource, that our attachment was the necessary resource. Mm-hmm. And so I apologized to her. And she's like, no one has ever apologized to me like that, right? And I'm like, we fixed the hole. You're always welcome. We want you here. It was my fault. It was my mistake. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
And just imagine, Nita, how many clients have been removed from practices, right? Because the therapist felt they were out of control. I mean, that's, again, I think that's the reluctant therapist to me. There's a lot of this work that you and I do over the last 40, 50 years that's been traumatizing for our clients, which is really disconcerting for me because we, you know, mm-hmm. many therapists will miss the whole contextual story. And our time is going so fast. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Nita Manley. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And I want to make sure that we connect because I want people to understand how large this contextual story is. And we talk about Indigenous people's trauma that's passed mm-hmm. along and colonized trauma. And mm-hmm. It's a three-part piece. I'm going to throw it out there and then you can break it down for me. But the three parts of multi-generational or Indigenous trauma or slavery, post-traumatic slavery syndrome starts with a dominant culture of perpetrators who take over a non-dominant population and cause mass trauma through either colonizing these people, through slavery, through war, through genocide. And this population that has been traumatized shows physical and psychological symptoms in response to the trauma that changes their DNA and RNA, that it becomes so rooted in their somatic system that it is then passed on to subsequent generations that we see now in 2021 that could have been perpetrated in the 1700s or in, you know, the taking over of all the indigenous lands in the United States, that when we see addictions and physical responses and suicide in indigenous populations or in, you know, any repressed or enslaved or colonized population, that we have to look at that original dominant culture's perpetration of mass trauma before we look at an individual and say, you're an addict.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
And so how does the healing happen, I guess? I just want to make sure we leave with you, but how does the healing happen from 300 years of oppression and trauma?
I think a big part of it is around restoration. Always, to me, trauma is restoring the person to their most natural whole self. Like the whole self, almost like the whole self before trauma. Like what trauma does. Right.
Okay.
So the trauma in and of itself is when parts of the self become uncoupled and disconnected. And nobody knows how to put it back together. They may be well-intentioned, just like I'm sure my clients, therapists who said you got to do this cognitive behavior therapy were well-intentioned, but that's not restoring her to her whole self. Reclaim the stories of the ancestors, reclaiming practices of the ancestors, being able to sit with even imagining what were my ancestors, what were their lives like before slavery?
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. What did they sing? How did they dance? How did they worship? How did they hold each other? How did they know they belonged? What did they look like to each other? What were their rituals? What were the stories that they told about their gods, their land, you know? And once you understand that, the rest kind of, the troubles in the present make sense because they've been disconnected from all of that.
Source.
Not only are they disconnected from who they were as a whole people, then oftentimes the modalities that we use is not reconnecting them in that. It's like, and now you get a chance to be more like me. Mm-hmm. Now you get a chance to be like Freud. You get a chance to be like Jung. You can be like somebody else who's a European American or white European. And that's the standard of health. While at the same time, it almost takes them further away from their whole self.
Like the intended practice of CBT is to separate someone from negative cognitions and behaviors, and instead we're reinforcing cognitions that are making people sick.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. That they're not, like my client said, that somehow they're not good enough as they are. And that they have to adapt the majority religion, the majority way of speaking, even the majority's concept of time, the way the majority feels about the land or water, that it's okay for them to turn on their faucet and be able to light the water and have flames shoot out of the faucet, right? That they're... that talking to their ancestors is a little bit leaning towards psychosis, right? Things like that. When actually, you know, the decolonizing incorporates transpersonal experiences that people have. People need to talk to their ancestors or access the resources of the ancestors, the religion, the languaging, all of that. it's restorative. Once you're restored to your whole self, then you go into the world as a whole person. Mm-hmm. And those unnecessary or problematic defensive accommodations begin to just slip away.
In some ways, a lot of those accommodations are numbing practices.
Exactly.
Drinking to excess, drugs, right? Those things that we're trying to numb ourselves to what is missing.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so in your practice, in the book that you're writing, Healing Cultural and Intergenerational Trauma, A Decolonized Trauma, are you feeling that your work is going to be moving towards a restorative practice? Are you going to be
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
The food that your clients are eating and how they are dressing. I mean, is it that fundamental for you now that trauma needs
there's permission for that, but it's not a requirement. Mm-hmm. It's more a restoration of themselves as a whole self, mm-hmm. as someone who has power and agency to defend and protect themselves, to say stop and no, to be able to say, okay, I talk to my grandmother every morning before I make a decision, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. Right? I have waking dreams. And my ancestors talk to me, and that's okay. Whatever it is, that it's coming from the whole self, which also includes our resiliencies.
Yes, right, because developing the resilience also helps us move to our whole self, that we know that we can, because as you said at the opening of the show, trauma is inevitable if you are a human being, but how we respond to and bounce back from and the tools mm-hmm. we have are what separate long-term trauma and healing. Anita, our hour just flew by. I need to have you back again. Here we are. But if people wanted to get in touch with you, if they've heard this and it's resonating, can they find you?
Yes, they can. They can find, I'm on Instagram.
Okay.
And I'm also, they can also email me at Anita M, A-N-I-T-A M as in Mary, at centerforcontextualchange.org.
And we'll throw that up on our Instagram also for people if you want to connect with Anita. Anita, thank you so much for your time. I've loved this hour. We will try to answer any questions that are up on Instagram Live before we leave today. But for now, thank you for being part of our conversation today. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook, send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. As always, I appreciate you tuning in and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'll see you next Tuesday at 2.
Thank you so much for having me, hosting me, Elizabeth. Very humbled, very honored to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Telling jokes and playing spades. Uncle Dave is on the barbecue grill. Grandma bragging about the blanket she made for the new baby on her way. Even though